Okay, thanks for coming, everybody. It's good to see everyone, and we'll go ahead with our study of Job. If you notice today, we're starting at 8:33, so we have nearly 2 hours for our class today. So we ought to get at least halfway through the outline or so. But what we're going to do is continue with our study of Job. Last time we read the opening chapters where Job goes through this horrible ordeal. He goes through a lot of suffering and endures it with a lot of faithfulness, and yet at the same time, eventually he becomes extremely discouraged, extremely hurt by everything that's happened, and expresses some deep discouragement, despair, desire to die. And so what we're going to do today is pick up where we left off, where we're going to see his friends who had come to comfort him, responding to his feelings, responding to the things that he is struggling with. Jack is going to lead us in a short time of prayer to get started, and then we'll get into Job chapter 4.
Our Father and God, we're thankful for the time you've given us to study your word, to learn more about you and your interaction with us. Help us to take away things that will help us to realize what we need to do and what our relationship with you needs to be. In your son's name we pray.
Amen. All right, thanks very much. Let's go ahead and go over to Job chapter 4. We'll read the chapter, and then in the course of talking about the chapter, we'll also do a brief recap of Job chapters 1 through 3. Picking up at the beginning of chapter 4, if we could have some of our usual outstanding crowd read here. Phil, why don't you pick up with the first 6 verses there, just because I know this guy is one of your friends and you'd like to talk about him a little bit. Don, could you go after that from verse 7 to 11? And then Perry, since I see you have your unclean little mechanical device there, why don't you cleanse it by reading Scripture, verses 12 to 21 of Job chapter 4. Job chapter 4.
Then Eliphaz the Temanite replied, "If someone ventures a word with you, will you be impatient? Who can keep from speaking? Think how have instructed many, how you have strengthened feeble hands. Your words have supported those who stumble. You have strengthened bold and needy. But now trouble comes to you, and you are discouraged. It strikes you, and you are dismayed. Should not your piety be your confidence, and your blameless ways your hope?
Remember now, whoever perished being innocent, well, where were the upright destroyed? According to what I have seen, those who plow iniquity and those who sow trouble harvest it. By the breath of God they perish, and by the blast of his anger they come to an end. The roaring of the lion and the voice of the fierce lion and the teeth of the young lion were broken. The lion perishes from the lack of prey, and the wealth of the lion is scattered."
End of the chapter. Go to the end of the chapter. I got it.
Charges his angels with error, how much more those who live in the house of clay, whose foundations are in the dust, who are crushed more rapidly or readily than a moth. Between dawn and dusk they are broken to pieces. Unnoticed they perish forever. Are not the cords of their tent pulled up so that they die without wisdom?
Okay, so this is in response to Job's speech that we read in chapter 3 last time. After all the things that happened to Job, we read of how some awful things happened to him through no fault of his own, and Job expressed his discouragement, his despair, and now his friends are going to try to cheer him up a little bit. They're going to try and pick him up off the ground after all the stuff that he's been through. And this first guy, Eliphaz, is really the nicest of the three. He's the least misguided of the three, but he still is really missing some important things. He kind of combines some very good insights with some serious misconceptions. So we want to kind of talk about what he explains to Job in this chapter and the next chapter, because all that he says is really no different from a lot of things that we also tend to believe and the ways that we also tend to approach a lot of problems. So Eliphaz is kind of here in the Bible not for us to criticize so much as for us to see that, yeah, this is the way we tend to deal with some of life's troubling questions, and we should learn to be a little bit deeper than this guy. Now, just to recap, you remember what happened in the first couple chapters. You know, Job was what kind of a guy? He was a righteous guy, had a good relationship with God, was very concerned about God and appreciative for what he had. From a worldly point of view, what do we know about Job?
Wealthy,
right? Had a lot of stuff, had a lot of wealth as measured by the time, had a big, happy family. And one day, he did something really bad, and so he lost everything, right? Well, the "he lost everything" part is right, but it had nothing to do with him. It was because Satan kind of challenged God almost to let him do his worst with Job. And Satan claimed that Job was only faithful because he had so many good things in his life. And God said, no, that's not true. And God allowed Satan, for no other reason, to hurt Job. Job lost all of his possessions, all his wealth. Satan took away all his possessions, his animals and everything, and Satan even killed all his family. And it's one of the kind of things, you know, today, that's a kind of sensationalistic news story that everybody would be talking about and babbling about and talking about their own silly ideas about why it happened. You have CNN send their special investigative reporter down to Bermuda to file in-depth coverage on the way that the Job crisis is affecting the Caribbean economy. And you'd have Fox News explaining why this whole thing is caused because we have a president who's really a Muslim. And then everyone would just be in this big tizzy over it. And then the next time that we see Satan and God, Satan still hasn't had enough, has he? He wants more of Job. And so God lets him do even worse. He lets Satan afflict Job with this horrible disease that makes every part of his body ache with pain and suffering. And so it makes it even worse. And so this time CNN sends their investigative reporter to a ski resort in Switzerland to file a special in-depth coverage on how the Job crisis will affect the next Winter Olympics. And Fox News has a special commentator explaining that this whole thing is the fault of the president and his health care plan. So everybody just standing around with their own silly opinions and agendas, and Job's sitting there suffering. And Job's three friends come to meet him, and at first they do something very wise. What do? They just sit there, and they're quiet, and they just are with him, and they listen, and they don't do a thing. Well, after a good while of this, Job, we read in chapter 3 last time, expresses his deep despair. And he expresses that he's very unhappy about this. He wants one thing now. What does he want?
Die.
He wants to die. He just said, I might as well just die. I mean, my life has fallen apart here, and I want to die. And yet, all that time, never once does he accuse God of any wrongdoing. He's just very depressed. And it's an important difference, because a lot of times when we approach people who, like Job, are suffering, we focus on the fact that they're depressed and it kind of gets us down and they're not really following our brilliant suggestions for how to fix all their problems and they're not really listening to our wonderful theories about why they have all these problems, and it's just annoying. And so we kind of tend to do the same thing that Job's friends do, is just talk about our own ideas and our own beliefs instead of actually meeting the needs that might be there. And this guy Eliphaz, basically what he is saying is he has this preconception that really, if you really look at it, the innocent never really suffer. It's the wicked who are punished. If you really look at it from the right point of view, good is always rewarded and evil is always punished. That's really what he believes. And he believes this based on experience. Eliphaz is not a theologian. There's these other two guys, Bildad and Zophar, that we're going to meet later. Phil already has chatted with them, and so he already knows all about these characters, but we'll see these guys later. They're actually even worse than Eliphaz. Eliphaz actually is a pretty well-intentioned guy. It's just he's afraid to question his own assumptions about God. He lives in this comfortable little 1950s world where good is always rewarded and evil is always punished. And he sees things happening that to him reinforce that. And so what his advice to Job is here in verse 6. Where does he think Job should put his confidence? He says, should not your piety be your confidence? Shouldn't you put your confidence in your goodness, your righteousness? Because if you just do good things, isn't that what God wants? And so if you give God what he wants, what will God do? He will give you what you want. You know, the old quid pro quo view of God, which is really, all Eliphaz is doing is saying explicitly what a lot of us think in our hearts, is that God is there to be manipulated into giving me what I want. And so if it makes him happy for me to sit down and pray and read my Bible, that's what I'll do, because I know I'll get rewarded for it. And if it makes him happy, if I pass up some opportunity to engage myself in some pleasurable sin, I'll do it because he'll give me something else that's at least as pleasurable in return for it. That's really what a lot of us think in our hearts. And when we look at the confusing and disturbing world around us, a lot of times we have the same concept that Eliphaz has, and we're afraid to question it. What he says in verse 7, who being innocent has ever perished? Were the upright ever destroyed? Was there anybody who really was good who really was destroyed? Well, see, Eliphaz looks out at the world and he sees, yeah, there are a lot of evil people there. He understands that there's a lot of wickedness out there. But he's seen a lot of wicked people that have been punished or harmed by their own folly, by their own sin. And that reassures him. And he's seen other people who have done good things and gotten rewarded for them. And that reinforces his view of the world. The problem is, as Adrian Monk likes to say, here's the thing. Yes, that does happen a lot of the time, but what else happens a lot of the time? There are a lot of evil people who profit very handsomely on this earth from their sinfulness. And there are a lot of good, righteous people who suffer sometimes just randomly from living in a fallen world, but sometimes as a direct result of their goodness, because they willingly pass up the chance to take revenge on someone. They don't use violence in response to violence. They don't respond to hate with hate. The early Christians are certainly the best example of that. They didn't change the world around them by being violent, by hating, by becoming angry, by engaging in confrontation. They changed the world around them by allowing themselves to be persecuted and tortured and killed, and showing people after watching this day after day, year after year, hey, these people really are something different. Christians, unfortunately, in our society tend to respond in kind to the world's hatred and violence. Job is an example of the kind of person who suffers unjustly, and he is suffering not for anything he has done. Now, Eliphaz has some important things on right. He talks in that last part of the chapter where Perry read, and it's just as vivid even when Perry read it from his little unclean device as it is if you read it on a nice clean page of paper with scripture on it. He's talking about how he trembles before the presence of God, the voice of God. Eliphaz has a proper respect for God. It's just that Eliphaz doesn't really understand God as well as he could. Can a mortal be more righteous than God? Well, no, absolutely not. He understands that. He understands that God's righteousness is so much greater than ours. But what Eliphaz doesn't really grasp is that he's trying too hard to squeeze and push what's happened to Job into his own little framework. He doesn't want to reevaluate his misconceptions. And so he's very true and very eloquent. He says, if God places no trust in his servants and charges his angels with error, how much more those who live in houses of clay? How much more vulnerable are we before God? How much more humble should we be before God? And he's exactly right. And you might remember that phrase, houses of clay. There's a passage in 2 Corinthians 4. Paul says, we have this treasure in what? In jars of clay. And Eliphaz has that same concept. He understands, yeah, we're just little jars of clay. We're very vulnerable. And so we really are at the mercy of God. We really need to be keenly aware of that. He's very correct in saying that. So when he tells Job to do that, he's very true. The problem is he's got this comfortable misconception that if Job just gets with the program, that he'll benefit immediately from being righteous. That if he had not done something wrong somewhere, there'd be a problem. And it's the kind of thing that the human mind just struggles with. There's a lot of things that happen in this world, and our society has become a lot more complicated than when Eliphaz lived, that if you really want to maintain that idea that everything really works out fine for people who are good. As Ricky Ricardo used to say to his wife, you've got a lot of explaining to do. There's just a lot of things that you have to do, all these logical contortions to explain if you believe that. And, you know, I tend to make a lot of jokes about engineers, and rightly so. But it's also true that philosophers and academicians are just as bad when it comes to trying to explain things. Engineers are always trying to solve the problem with some clever little witticism or invention, but philosophers are just as bad. Your philosophers are just as bad at trying to explain away things with their reasoning and their brilliance and everything. I happen to get this journal from the Society of Christian Philosophers, and this just actually came just a couple weeks ago. It's the October 2012 issue, which tells you a little bit about this group. You know, they are philosophers. You know, if their journal says it's October 2012, is it really March or is it really October? In their to them, it is October. Well, they happen to have an article about unfair suffering. And it's a perfect example of the kind of thing that philosophers do, that in the theologians do. He's talking about, this is a guy who basically believes that God is good, God is perfect, and he wants to respond philosophically to an atheist who's critiqued that God lets horrible, unjust suffering happen. And he's responding specifically, this atheist had written, I read a story in the paper about this horrible forest fire, and they found this adorable little fawn that had been burned horribly in this forest fire and suffered a horrible death. You know, that's the kind of thing I respond to viscerally, because I feel bad for animals. I feel very bad for the suffering that they undergo, usually at the hands of human folly. Well, this guy's trying to show how some fawn suffering a horrible, senseless death really is okay if you look at it the right way. And here's his answer. He says, we construe row 3 as claiming that the noceum feature of suffering is prima facie evidence against theism, and the step from row 2 to row 3 is best construed as drawing upon the norms governing how things epistemically appear to one. It is licensed by an epistemic principle of justification that Swinburne calls the principle of credulity. When something epistemically appears to be a certain way, then it is reasonable for one, barring defeaters, to believe that it is that way. My approach can be summarized as follows. On the basis of cognized situation S, human H is entitled to claim it appears that P only if it is reasonable for H to believe that, given his or her cognitive faculties and the use he or she has made of them, if P were not the case, S would likely be different than it is in some way discernible to him or her. Does that make you feel better about that poor little fawn? What is this character trying to do? He's trying to control the situation. He's trying to explain it away. The other philosophers are just as bad. In the 1800s, there was a school of philosophy called utilitarianism. John Stuart Mill, he believed in what was called a utility calculus, that if you just use the right mathematical formulas, you can maximize the happiness in the world. And they really believed that, and people thought they were brilliant. The point is for us not to do the same thing. In our understanding and use of Scripture, to understand that it's just not that simple. There's a lot of suffering that goes unredeemed, that goes uncompensated for. And as Christians, it's best that we acknowledge that and not try to explain it away. Let's continue with Eliphaz's talk here in chapter 5. He's going to talk about what to do when we need help. Chapter 5, picking up in verse 1. Frank, could you read that, verse 1 to 7? And then Gloria, thank you for volunteering as always. Could you read verse 8 to 16? And then Norma, I'll let you take the end of the chapter. Since it's having a little chapter mark, we'll make it at least reasonably likely that you'll stop when you get there.
Call if you will, for who are engineers? To which of the holy ones will you turn? Resentment kills a fool, and envy slays the simple. I myself have seen a fool taking root, but suddenly his house was cursed. His children are far from safety, working for it without a defender. The hungry consume his harvest, taking it even amongst the thorns, and the thirsty man after him as well. For hardship does not spring from the soil, nor does trouble sprout from the grass. But man is born in trouble, as surely as sparks fly upward.
Thank you. you will know that your path is secure. Your full stock and your property can find nothing missing. You will know that your children will be men and your descendants will be
all right, excellent. Thank you very much. This is the end of Eliphaz's talk for now. We're going to see him again in chapter 15 and chapter 22. So if you actually enjoyed him, you'll get to run into him again. What he's talking about here is he's elaborating on his belief that somehow or another, good is rewarded and evil is always punished. And he kind of turns that to the question of, well, okay, Job, you're in trouble. So what do you do now? What do you do when you need help? He's advised Job to put his confidence in his own piety, his own righteousness. And now he tells him, and a lot of what he says is true in this chapter. He tells him to turn to God. He says, the righteous can't help you, so you got to turn to God. He understands that. It's very, very good. And he has this concept that's also very true. It just, he doesn't quite get it right. He has this phrase where he talks about the difficulties that we often face. He says, verse 7, man is born to trouble. And I kind of use that for the theme verse because it's one of the things that Job's friends and Job both understand. When we get down to chapter 7, Job basically asks the same question. He says, why is life so hard? Why is there so much trouble down here? And it's one of the things that we should not run away from, because we're told many times in the New Testament that this life is not going to be easy. John 16:33, in this world you will have trouble. Therefore, be good boys and girls, and then you won't have as much trouble. Is that what Jesus said? No. He said, in this world you'll have trouble, but I've overcome the world. Take heart, because I've overcome the world. And so they're both right. Eliphaz and Job are both right when they're saying we're born to trouble. But Eliphaz's concept of that is a little bit too limited, because look at what he's saying. He says, yeah, you're just going to get in a lot of trouble, Job. You're going to goof a lot of things up and you're going to pay for it. Eliphaz basically, again, he believes that our troubles in life come from our own mistakes. He believes that when you struggle, there's a reason there somewhere. That little fawn that got burned up in the fire, it did something wrong. I mean, it said something nasty to another fawn or something, who knows? But we know it did something, because we know that's the way the world works. See, Eliphaz is not able to ask the big questions. Eliphaz doesn't want to ask the tough questions. He wants to take what he already believes and force everything into that framework. And the thing is that's he's not a bad guy at all. It's just human nature to want to do that. It's our impulse also to not want to ask the big, difficult questions about God. We're afraid. Eliphaz believes he's being faithful. Eliphaz believes he's being a righteous defender of God. And we tend to think the same thing. When atheists question that the pain in the world and the suffering and the injustice, we tend to think God needs us to defend him and protect him. But you know, God is still God no matter what atheists say. He doesn't need us to protect him. This is a fallen world. God knows that. God created it with that understanding. It's full of sinful people who have free will. A lot of bad things are going to happen. God knows that. He accepts the spiritual responsibility that comes with that, which is one of the reasons why he sent his son into the world. He wants us to not try to stamp out or explain away suffering, but to try to redeem it. Because what Eliphaz is saying, when he talks about God's transcendent nature, in itself, it's actually some very wonderful thoughts. This passage from verse 8 to 16, this is Eliphaz at his best. The only time he was even better than in this passage is when he wasn't saying anything at all. He says some very nice things here. He talks about how God performs wonders that cannot be fathomed, miracles that cannot be counted. He brings us the rain and the water. He's able to thwart the plans of the crafty. He's able to help the needy. He's able to humble the powerful and help the weak. All that's very, very true. And it's very important for us to realize that about God. The problem Eliphaz has is that he wants to use that idea and fit it into his framework of God instead of expanding his framework of God. He sees this horrible thing that happened to Job for no reason, and instead of questioning his view of God, he wants to force it into his view of God. And that's the kind of thing that we all struggle with that. We do it as individuals, we do it as churches. People get frustrated with discouraged people or people who ask inconvenient questions because we've got agendas. We've got programs that we want people to be part of. And we want them to be part of that, not sitting there asking questions. When someone's struggling, we just say, hey, look, brother, say amen a little louder and you'll feel better. Join the small group and your problems will go away. Fair. See, we fixed it for you. We don't want to get in there and discuss these tough, troubling questions. God is not afraid of us asking these questions. And Job, as we're going to see, actually understands that. So when Eliphaz talks about the discipline of the Almighty, blessed is the man whom God corrects, so don't despise the discipline of the Almighty. There again, absolutely true. But his misunderstanding, he thinks that what happened to Job is discipline in the sense that Job's either done something wrong or that he needs to be taught a lesson here for some reason. He doesn't understand that discipline sometimes comes as a general experience of living in a tough, fallen world, not that you're getting punished for something you did wrong. Eliphaz believes in a deterministic God, that God did this so that he can do that, that God is pulling all the strings like the Godfather, making everything happen according to a predetermined plan. And it's one of the funny things about us that when we run into some Calvinist or Presbyterian who believes in predestination, you know, we jump right up with all the scriptures that refute it. But then we turn right around and say, oh, God did that because he's going to do this, and he let that happen because he's going to do that, as if God has every little detail planned out. Because there's a false comfort in having a God who predetermines everything. There's a false comfort in that. That's why people believe in predestination. There's a false comfort in that. If I'm saved, I'm saved. If I'm lost, I lost. I don't have anything to say about it. Therefore, I can do whatever I feel like. There's a false comfort for us in explaining away all the bad things that happen. Oh, no, God had a reason for it. The subtle difference is God will use anything that happened. It doesn't mean he made everything happen. God didn't do that so that. God will take the worst things and the most sinful things and find a way to use it if we let him. That's a big difference. It's a mistake to say, oh, no, God did that bad thing to you so that he can do this. No, you can say, well, God will find a way to use that, but in and of itself, that's a pretty horrible thing you're going through, isn't it? There's a false comfort in having things predetermined. You guys know who Rod Serling is, right? The Twilight Zone. He actually had another show after The Twilight Zone. Now, I'm doing this for you, Frida, because I know you like Rod Serling. And so I hope in return you won't do too much cheating on the trivia questions as a fair trade. You probably forgot your phone is the only reason you're not doing it. He had another show after The Twilight Zone called The Night Gallery, and there's an episode of The Night Gallery where there was this comedian who was, he was a real bad comedian. He was working in these dingy nightclubs. The jokes he told were real stale. Nobody laughed. He was real discouraged. He's actually played by, if you remember, Godfrey Cambridge, who's actually a very funny man, but in the show, he was this terrible, crummy comic. And he meets this genie, and the genie gives him a wish. And he says, I want people to laugh at everything I say. And so all of a sudden, he's the big comic star. He tells the stupidest jokes, the lamest jokes, and everybody just roars laughing. Oh, it's great. So he's getting all kind of big engagements, and he's getting all kind of money coming in. And this big Broadway producer sees him on stage and thinks, this guy's terrific. I'm going to give him the lead role in my next play. And so he says, this is really what he wants, you know, real legitimacy. He's going to be a star on Broadway in this great new play, great famous director, famous author. The problem is that there's one scene in the play, it's a real tragic scene, and he has to give this really emotional, tragic speech. And so he does a great job. He does a brilliant job bringing out the sadness and the emotion, and everyone bursts out laughing. Everyone just roars with laughter at it, and the director says, I made a mistake. All this guy's just a comic, can't do anything. So now this comic, he's crushed, he's devastated, and he sees the genie again. He says, oh, you didn't tell me that this would happen. Well, you didn't ask, you know, you just said you wanted everybody to laugh. He says, okay, I want another wish. I want to make people cry. I want to make people feel terrible. And the genie says, it's granted. And the guy walks out of the building, walks across the road, gets hit by a car and is killed. And so everyone's sitting around, of course, crying and was shocked by this. See, we take an unreasonable and unjustified amount of false security in knowing what will happen. And if we can't know what will happen, it gives us a false security thinking that God knows what will happen. God's got everything predetermined. And even though we know the problems with Calvinism, we sometimes forget that in real life, a lot of stuff happens randomly. There's a lot of free will floating around down here, and it's very inconvenient and very messy. Eliphaz is the kind of guy who wants to debate and argue about the little questions of life, but he's not willing to probe the big troubling questions. And as Christians, that's what Jesus came to do, is bring answers to the big questions, the troubling questions, not the little trivia that we argue about. Getting into Job's response, Job has listened to this, and now he says, chapter 6, Job replied, "If only my anguish could be weighed and all my misery be placed on the scales, it would surely outweigh the sand of the seas. No wonder my words have been impetuous. The arrows of the Almighty are in me. My spirit drinks in their poison. God's terrors are marshaled against me. Does a wild donkey bray when it has grass, or an ox bellow when it has fodder? Is tasteless food eaten without salt, or is there flavor in the white of an egg? I refuse to touch it. Such food makes me ill." Now, you'll notice, what is he saying? He's not really saying much of anything except that he's really depressed, isn't he? These images don't really even make a lot of sense, do they? But it's just expressive of how frustrated and confused he is. He's hungry, he's thirsty, he wants something, and he doesn't know where to find it. Well, he says something now. He's crushed, but he's still alive. Verse 8, "That I might have my request that God would grant what I hope for, that God would be willing to crush me, to loose his hand and cut me off." See, he's so crushed, but he's still alive. Death would be preferable. But Job does something very wise. He says, he thinks about, well, can I find something? Can I find some joy amidst the pain? Well, I would still have this consolation, my joy amidst unrelenting pain, that I hadn't denied the words of the Holy One. Job looks and he says, nothing else that I want. I don't have it anymore. Nobody's listening to me. Nobody's going to help me. But here's one thing I can do, one thing I can control amidst all this stuff. I can control whether I'm faithful to God or not. And that's going to be my joy. That's what I'm going to do. No matter what, I'm going to be true to God. However little I understand what he's doing, however confused I am about things, I'm going to be true to God, and that's going to be my joy. Job has a very healthy understanding of God. He values his relationship with God. He values the presence of God for its own sake. He's not going to try to be a good boy just so God gives him back what he took away. He's not going to try to be good and faithful just so he gets paid some kind of indemnity for what he suffered. He values faithfulness for its own sake. This is something that Job has on right, even though he's very depressed and is missing a lot of other things that are going on. Job understands that in this chaotic world, this fallen world, this painful, unjust world, that's one thing no one can take away from us if we don't let them, is we can be faithful to God, we can have that relationship with God, and that is a value in itself, completely independent of what God does for us, completely independent of if God gives us the things we want or does not give us the things we want. And so Job says in verse 11, "What strength do I have that I should still hope? What prospects that I should be patient? Do I have the strength of stone? Is my flesh bronze? Do I have any power to help myself now that success has been driven from me? A despairing man should have the devotion of his friends, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. But my brothers are as undependable as intermittent streams, as the streams that overflow when darkened by thawing ice and swollen with melting snow." He says, my small strength is failing. These friends of mine, they're just kind of chatting about their theological theories, so I can't really count on them. So what hope do I have? Well, the only thing I can think of is I'm going to be faithful. The only thing I'm going to be thankful is I'm going to be faithful to God. And he expresses a lot of hope and disappointment. He has some imagery here. He talks about these streams that are going dry during the hot, dry season. He goes on in the next few verses to talk about a caravan in the desert, desperately looking for some water. Because what he's expressing is spiritual thirst. And the thing that you notice about Job when you read all these words, all the depressing thoughts and all the things that many of us would probably rebuke Job for saying, he never, ever criticizes God, and he never even asks for anything back. He never even says, why don't you give me back what I lost? Why don't you do this to pay me back? All he is doing is saying, would someone please listen to my questions, acknowledge that they're legitimate questions, and at least give me something to think about and by way of an answer. So when he says, verse 21, "You too have proved to be no help. You see something dreadful and are afraid. Have I ever said, give something on my behalf? Pay a ransom for me from your wealth? Deliver me from the hand of the enemy? Ransom me from the clutches of the ruthless?" He's telling the truth. He hasn't asked any of that stuff. He doesn't want them to try to make up for what he suffered, because he knows they can't. We can't help each other to take away the horrible things we've suffered. What we can offer each other is something different. And so when he goes on to say, you know, I'm really not asking for that much, he really is telling the truth. All he wants right now is for people just to stop with their theorizing and just listen. Hey, I'm raising some troubling questions here. And I really just want you to right now to understand that they're legitimate questions. And they are legitimate questions. Job is asking, why keep up hope? Because the suffering he's gone through has helped him to see something beyond his own trouble. He's starting to see the world in a new way. Because he's had a very blessed life. And Satan was certainly correct about one thing, is that in a sense it's easier for someone like that to have faith. But Satan was dead wrong about another thing. Is this guy Job, that's not the reason for his faith. Because when all this bad stuff happens to him, he doesn't get accusatory towards God. He doesn't demand to be paid back. He just wants to understand things a little bit better. He's been shown a new aspect of life on this world that he never saw before. And this is what he talks about in chapter 7. Why is life so hard? Chapter 7, does not man have hard service on earth? Are not his days like those of a hired man? Like a slave longing for the evening shadows, or a hired man waiting eagerly for his wages, so I have been allotted months of futility and nights of misery have been assigned to me. When I lay down, I think how long before I get up. The night drags on, and I toss till dawn. What is he saying about the nature of our mortal condition? He's saying there are times when this life just seems to drag, and time just passes so slowly when you're going through the agony down here. It just lasts so long, and especially when you're in the middle of an agony like he is, you never know when it's going to end. You never know if it's going to end. And he talks about, see, it's raised his sensitivity. It hasn't made him selfish. Now he looks out there and sees all these slaves that I never gave a thought to before. Boy, I bet it's even worse for them, because their life's like this all day long. They have nothing to begin with. At least I had it for a while. And life just must drag on for them, waiting all day just for the sun to set so they can go and get a little bit of sleep and then do the whole dreary routine all over again. And he says, you know, this life, it can really be tough. Time just drags so slowly. And then he notices something different. In the next verse he says, verse 6, my days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle. They come to an end without hope. Remember, O God, that my life is but a breath. What else is true about our mortal lives? Well, not only does time pass too slowly, it also passes too quickly. We don't have time to do the things we want to do. We don't have time to experience the things we want to experience. We don't have time to enjoy the things that we want to enjoy. You get them for a short time and then they're gone. Or you got to move on to something else, or something else happens. And Job is simply describing that this is, see, he has the same concept. Eliphaz had said, man is born to trouble. But he understood that on a very superficial level. Job understands, yeah, we're born to trouble because we're mortal, not because it's our fault, just because we're mortal beings. And yeah, this, as Jesus would say hundreds of years later, yeah, in this world, we're just going to have trouble, aren't we? Because it's an inherent problem. Sometimes time passes so slowly and time passes too quickly. Well, time has to do with being mortal. It's our nature. Time is a crushing weight to carry around for a mortal, and it's just the nature of the thing. It's not something that we can cure just by being good. We can't change our mortal nature in this world just by being good. And so he says, picking up in verse 11, therefore I will not keep silent. I will speak out in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. And so Job is, again, he's very honest. Yeah, I'm really letting it all out right here. You know, Job is not going to have that phony veneer of spirituality where he's going through these horrible things and someone says, hey, how you doing, Job? Oh, I'm just doing fine. Going through a little bit of a tough time right now, but I'm praying about it. He's letting people know, yeah, I'm really struggling here. I really want some answers here. But again, see, the crucial difference is Job's not being selfish. Job is asking some very honest questions. And you just stop to think, how would someone like Job be dealt with in the church today, expressing some of these things? People get very impatient with him. You're not supposed to talk about stuff like that, Job. And people would be like Eliphaz, giving him false hope, trying to give him reasons to go on, the little inspirational stories that we come up with. Well, Job, I knew a guy who lost everything he had, and he's had all this terrible stuff happen to him, and one day God just sent him a lottery ticket in the mail, and the next day he won $20 million, and his life was great after that. We just want to tell those little stories like that. You may have heard Christopher Columbus, when he was on his trip from Spain to come to explore what he found out was America, and he was actually telling everybody that he was going to find a new trade route to the Indies by going around the world. Well, all these sailors that he hired, they were just there for the money, and so he was afraid that they wouldn't hold out because he knew it would be a long trip. He thought he was going to have to go all the way around the world and then come out back in India. And so Columbus actually made a false ship's log. He kept two set of logs. You know how the old sailors would calculate from the stars and with their mathematical formulas where they were, how far they'd been. Columbus actually kept the real set of his logs secret. He kept lying to his men and say, yeah, we've gone this many more miles today. Now we're only this many miles away. So we're gonna get there real soon. Yeah, we're gonna get there real soon. And the funny thing was, is it turns out his lies actually turned out to be true. His real logs, the ones that he thought were right, were way off. And the lies that he was telling the sailors actually turned out to be true. He actually landed in the Caribbean islands right about the time he was telling them that they would, even though he thought it was going to be a lot longer. And it's kind of an irony, because that's the kind of little fairy tale we like to tell people. We like to hold out the false hope of, if you just be good, everything will be fine. Just do what we tell you to do. We got a nice little program. If you just follow it, everything will be great. Now, sometimes it actually happens to be true, but like Eliphaz, that just encourages, doesn't it? Instead, we should just be honest from the beginning with people about the nature of the world. And that's all Job is asking for. As we get over to the trivia question, as I'm being directed by my cinematographer / director / executive producer to do, Job wants to know, what is it like to be a human being? And he's asked the question, I do want to mention this, verse 17, he has this question, what is a human? What is a person? What is man that you make so much of him, that you give him so much attention, that you, he's talking to God, that you examine him every morning and test him every moment? He wants to know, why, God, is it so complicated? Why is it so hard? And Job is just pleading for grace. He's not putting God on trial or anything. He just wants to ask the big questions and have them listened. God has not yet answered him in a way Job can grasp, and Job wants just to make sure that God is still there. Job is asking the big questions, whereas the Eliphazes of the world and a lot of Christians today just want to ask the little questions that they can control, squeeze into a little doctrinal debate or a little method that they can give somebody. Well, here's where we come into our trivia question. There's a senator from our nation's history called David Rice Acheson. And some historians believe that Senator Acheson holds an unusual distinction that has never been officially recognized. You know, most historians deny that this is true, but there's a lot of historians that believe that he did something that's never been officially recognized. So I gave you five choices, and they're all good ones. Do you think that Senator Acheson secretly competed in the Olympics under an assumed name? You think that's what he did? Do you think that he was really only 22 when he was elected, which is well below the legal minimum age to be a senator? Do you think that he was president of the United States for one day? Do you think that in 1930 he wrote an official report warning that there'd be a world war if Hitler came to power? Do you think that he is the true inventor of the telephone? Well, this guy, David Rice Acheson, is actually the kind of guy that's worth knowing about, because he is unfortunately very typical of our nation's history. Because he was a very powerful man, very popular man, and there's some very ugly things about him and his life. He was a senator back in the 1840s. In the 1850s, so that lets out the Hitler answer, and it lets out competing in the Olympics, because they didn't exist back then. He was a senator from the state of Missouri in the 1840s and the 1850s. Very powerful man, very popular, was very wealthy, and had a lot of supporters. He was very influential. He founded the town of Atchison, Kansas, which is famous from the name of the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad. David Rice Acheson was also one of the most vocal and influential supporters of slavery during his time. He had a big plantation, had lots of slaves, he was very brutal to his slaves, and he was very aggressive in promoting slavery. He founded the town of Atchison, Kansas as a slave-owning colony. And when people moved into to his little town from the northern states and did not support slavery, he hired a gang of thugs to kill them. He was the kind of person who was very brutal, very violent in supporting his beliefs, and yet he was very influential, very popular in his time. But if you read history books, and if you put his name into your search engine and see what it says about him, as I'm sure Frieda can verify for you, nobody cares about that. All they care is this little trivia distinction that people argue about. Because in 1849, he had an office in the Senate. There's an honorary office called the President Pro Tempore of the Senate, which is the guy who's appointed when the vice president isn't there. The President Pro Tempore takes charge of the Senate. It's only significant, that office, for that reason and for one other, and that it's in the line of succession to the presidency. In 1849, Zachary Taylor was going to be inaugurated as the new president, and Millard Fillmore as the new vice president. And Inauguration Day, which in the 1800s was on March the 4th, fell on a Sunday. Zachary Taylor and Millard Fillmore both decided we'd feel better not being sworn in on a Sunday. They were old-fashioned Sabbatarians. And so there was no new president for a day because President Polk's term expired and nobody had been sworn in. So David Rice Acheson, as the president pro tem of the Senate, was in a sense the acting president. And so people argue to this day over whether he was really president. You will find passionate arguments about why some historians believe he was really the president and he should be recognized. He should be called the 12th president of the United States. And people should realize it because it's our Constitution. And here's all the reasons in the Constitution. There's other people who say, no, no, no. That's not what the Constitution says. If you look at that article and that article, it's not the way that it really works. Maybe he was acting president, but that's nothing. And they go into these long arguments, which you can find on the internet. And he himself made jokes about it, is what I've read. He actually joked with his friends about which one would be a Secretary of the State, but he never actually tried to do anything. But see, here's the thing. Here's this guy who embodies a lot of troubling things about our country. This so-called Christian country, as a lot of you people are so fond of saying, that this kind of guy, a brute, a racist, an awful person, just because he was wealthy and had a certain southern charm to him, could become so powerful and popular. How does that happen? How does it happen today that we let so many ugly people get so much power and wealth and influence over us? But people don't want to ask those questions. They'd rather debate, was he really president for a day or not? Here's my reasons why I'm right and why you're wrong. And the same thing is true in the church. We get pretty passionate about why we've got organs and the other guys don't. We get pretty passionate about why we do the Lord's Supper every week and the other people don't, or why those other people who use just the one cup for the Lord's Supper, they're wrong, and we've got it right, and why we're right about all this other stuff. But we don't want to even listen to these big, troubling questions about all the suffering in the world, all the injustice in the world, all the things that people go through in our own church family, that we just want to give them the little pat answers. Get back on track, brother. Be encouraged. Yeah, God's doing it for a reason. And Job is simply saying, let's realize the fact that the world's a messy, messy place. And people need not to have their problems explained away or fixed or have someone pay for them, but to have them redeemed. To take this experience that we all go through in the world and redeem it through the blood of Christ. To show people that there is a way of overcoming this world. Not perfecting it, not going through and dispensing justice and rewarding everyone for all the things they've done right and punish everyone for done them wrong, but help them to overcome this world, to find a spiritual identity and a spiritual hope in the presence of God that overcomes this world. And that's what the book of Job is really teaching us. And Job did not even have the blood of Christ to look to. You see, in Hebrews, it tells us, this is another one of Frank's scriptures, by the way. You know, I've slipped these in once in a while. My approval rating gets pretty bad sometimes, so I've got to do what I can to improve it, at least in certain sectors. Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he could destroy the power of death and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. Jesus came to this world and experienced what it's like. He experienced the joys, he experienced the pains. He experienced the confusion, the limitations, the mortality, the sorrow, the temptations. He experienced it all. So he understands, and he's calling us to understand and to redeem the things that go on in this world and take this messy, painful world and turn it into something good. Not to try to come up with the little theologians' explanations or the little philosophers' formulas and theories, but to try to help people to overcome this world and move on to something greater. Thank you so much for your patient attention. Did okay with the schedule, didn't I? All righty. We'll see you next week. Thanks a lot.